Horace, she said, shouldering past Duane Sr. on her way out the door. Thank you, Millie, he called after her. She spun around on the steps. Thanks for what? Caring so much about the boy. Believe it or not, I care about both of you, Mrs. Winship said gruffly. Now go play with your parrot. Drake McBride went straight from the hospital to a suite at the swanky Ritz-Carlton Hotel so he could recuperate in high style. Jimmy Lee Bayless, following orders, brought the man with the bloodhound up to the room. The dog's name was Horace. It had humongous flappy ears and rubbery wet jowls and a nose like a loaf of gingerbread. It promptly lay down on the floor and dozed off in a puddle of drool.
Horace is tired, explained the handler. Is this all you got? We need more than one hound, Drake McBride complained. Nah, you don't, said the handler.
They hunt better alone. I checked it out with my buddies back in Houston, Jimmy Lee Bayless said.
Drake McBride, still sprawled in bed, insisted they needed a whole pack of dogs.
That's how they catch bears, right?
The handler said.
I didn't know you was after bears. I thought you was after humans.
We are, Jimmy Lee Bayless said. His stomach felt like he'd swallowed a handful of hot barbecue coals. He explained to his boss that Horace was a world-class manhunter. They use him to track down missing persons, lost hikers, escaped convicts. Twice he was on America's Most Wanted.
All he needs is a scent, the handler said. Do we have a scent? Drake McBride asked grumpily.
Jimmy Lee Bayless said, we do. The culprit's odor was on dozens of pink flags that he'd touched while rearranging them. When Drake McBride reached for a glass of water on the nightstand, he let out a yelp of pain, which caused Horace briefly to open his watery brown eyes and blink.
Mr. McBride got thrown from a horse and busted some ribs, Jimmy Lee Bayless informed the dog handler. Got me a concussion, too, Drake McBride added. Hey, partner, you know anybody who wants to buy a thoroughbred real cheap?
The handler said no. Can you get started today? Jimmy Lee Bayless asked. We'll take you out there by helicopter.
That's fine.
And you sure this dog can follow the smell of a person through a tropical swamp?
He can follow the smell of a person through a vinegar factory, the handler said.
Drake McBride pointed at the bloodhound, whose eyelids had once again sagged shut.
When will old Horace be done with his nap?
Whenever I say so.
How about right now? 'Cause I gotta talk to Mr. Bayless in private.
Drake McBride clapped his hands three times loudly.
Horace, wake up! Horace!
The dog did not stir, much to Jimmy Lee Bayless's dismay. Drake McBride scratched his unshaven cheeks.
Well, I ain't impressed. Let's find us another mutt, Jimmy Lee.
The bloodhound handler softly clicked his tongue. Horace sprang up from the floor as if electrified, nostrils in the air, tail erect, eyes wide and shining.
Don't call him a mutt, the handler said.
Drake McBride chuckled.
Sorry, Horace. Now will you two excuse us, please?
Jimmy Lee Bayless led the bloodhound and the handler to the door of the suite and said he'd meet them in the lobby in 10 minutes. When he returned to the bedroom, he found Drake McBride upright, massaging his head. His pajama shirt was unbuttoned, exposing his heavily taped chest.
My old man called last night, he said unhappily. I lied and told him everything down here was going smooth as silk.
And it will be, once we get rid of our problem. Jimmy Lee Bayless was well aware that the Red Diamond Energy Corporation wouldn't exist if it weren't for Drake McBride's rich father. He was also aware that Drake McBride's father had dwindling patience with Drake McBride. Sir, once that bloodhound hunts down this guy on the property,
or guys, Drake McBride said. Whoever's messing with our stuff.
Right. But after we catch them, what do we do with them? Jimmy Lee Bayless asked. What if they already found the pirate well? We can't call the cops on them because they just rat us out. Then you and me are the ones who get hauled off to jail.
No, we can't call the cops. Definitely not,
agreed Drake McBride. So what are we supposed to do with these vandals if they already know about Section 22, I mean? There was a pause that got heavier with each passing second.
I haven't worked out all the details, Drake McBride said finally. But we'll do whatever it takes to protect this project. You understand, partner? Whatever it takes.
It was not an answer that made Jimmy Lee Bayless's belly stop burning.
The digital clock by Nick's bed said 9:15, which was odd. On most Sunday mornings, his mother awoke him at 8 sharp so they could make buttermilk pancakes and bacon. He rolled out of bed and put on a robe. Down the hall came the sound of muffled voices. A discussion was underway. Through the window, he saw a gray U.S. Army van parked in the driveway. Nick ran to the living room just as his father was being helped into a wheelchair by 2 young soldiers. His mother stood stiffly by the door, the knuckles of one hand pressed to her chin.
What's going on? Nick asked.
Minor setback, his father said hoarsely. They missed me up at Walter Reed, I guess.
His face looked feverish and his eyes were red with fatigue. Nick turned to his mom.
Did the infection come back?
It never went away. One of the soldiers rolled the wheelchair out to the van, which had a ramp that elevated Nick's dad to the side door. The other soldier carried a small nylon suitcase that Nick's mother had packed, and he placed it in the van beside the wheelchair. Captain Gregory Waters kicked a woolen blanket off his legs and said,
I'm not 80 years old.
Nick's mother kissed his father goodbye and said, I'll come up and see you in a day or two.
Me too, Nick said.
No, sir. You're not missing one more day of school,
his father told him.
But, Dad, that's enough. I'll be home again before you know it.
He squeezed Nick's right arm.
Hey, are you keeping the sling off? Don't tell me you're giving up the Southpaw life.
Just wait. By the time you get back, I'll be a total hardcore lefty.
His father managed to smile, but Nick could see the pain in his face.
Yeah, Nicky.
We'll go fly fishing down in Everglades City. Just the two of us.
Nick and his mother waved as the van pulled out of the driveway, and they continued waving long after Captain Gregory Waters could no longer see them. Nick was dazed. The whole scene seemed like a terrible dream. His dad had seemed okay the night before.
What's going on, Mom? Tell me.
After breakfast, she said crossly.
I'm not hungry.
Well, I am. She was, too. 3 pancakes, 2 strips of bacon, a banana and a half cup of blueberries, and a tall glass of fresh-squeezed orange juice.
Nick picked in a bowl of dry granola. He waited, fidgeting, until his mother finished eating. There was no point in nagging her. After pouring herself a cup of coffee, she settled in and told him what had happened.
Remember when you tried to call your dad at the hospital, but he was gone?
Sure, that was the day he came home.
Yes, he came home, Nick's mother said. He came home without telling his doctors. Strolled out of Walter Reed at 4:30 in the morning, grabbed a cab, and went straight to the airport.
No way.
It was a foolish thing to do.
He wasn't ready, Nicky.
So he lied?
He didn't want us to worry.
Is he crazy or what? Nick said angrily.
Your dad wanted to be here more than anything. He was sure he'd get better faster if he was home with you and me.
But he didn't get better, Nick said bleakly. He got worse.
His mother was staring at her coffee, stirring it slowly with the wrong end of a spoon. She said, last night he woke up with chills and a 104-degree fever.
so I knew the infection wasn't gone. He was so miserable that he finally admitted the truth. He still got shrapnel from that rocket in his shoulder. He needs more surgery. Oh, no. Nick sagged in the chair. Your dad's a tough customer. He'll be all right. What about you, Mom? I'm pretty darn tough myself, in case you hadn't noticed. Now, she said, rising, I'd better go pack. I'm flying up to be with your father. Nick held her tight. I can't believe he bailed out of the hospital. If I ever did something like that, I'd be grounded for a year. It wasn't the brainiest move, Nick's mother agreed. But he missed us, Nicky, that's all. Let's just be thankful he's not in Iraq anymore. As soon as the doctors in Washington finish fixing him, he'll be home for good. After his mom left, Nick tried to keep busy and not worry about his dad. He cleaned the kitchen sink and loaded his dirty laundry into the washing machine and worked some algebra problems and rewrote the outline for an English essay that wasn't due for 2 weeks. Marta called twice, but Nick didn't answer the phone. He wasn't in the mood to talk with any of his friends. For lunch, he fixed a peanut butter sandwich, but he took only 3 bites. He had absolutely no appetite and too much nervous energy. So he put on a Red Sox cap and went out to the backyard and threw baseballs left-handed at the pitching net until his elbow throbbed. There was so much he'd wanted to talk to his father about. Yet he understood that this was no time to be selfish. It was essential for his dad to return to the hospital and get the operation he needed. After retrieving the balls from the net, Nick lugged the bucket back to the homemade pitching mound and resumed throwing again, as hard as he could, despite the burning ache. In the middle of a wind-up, a voice from behind said, "You're gonna wreck your arm, dude." Nick spun and saw Smoke walking his motorcycle around the corner of the house. "What are you doing here?" Nick asked. Dwayne Scrod Jr. leaned the bike against the wall and said, "You gotta help me. They turned a manhunter dog loose out there near the camp."
"Who did?"
"The oil company."
"Where's Twilly?"
"Running like crazy. He's the one told me to come see you." Smoke looked around nervously. "I can't hide out at home because of the cops. Now they got a squad car parked right in front of the house."
"What about Mrs. Starch and the baby panther?" Nick said.
"They're okay so far, but that dog is good, man. That dog is a pro."
"How can I help?" asked Nick, knowing what the answer would be.
"I need a place to stay," Smoke said, "just for a while."
"Sure."
Nick dropped the baseball into the bucket. He wondered how, even if he should tell his mom, it would probably be the first time she had a fugitive as a house guest.
23. Detective Jason Marshall didn't usually work on Sundays, but he wasn't going to relax until he tracked down Dwayne Scrod Jr., the missing arson suspect. It didn't help that the other detectives kept needling him because the kid had dashed away before he could snap on the handcuffs and then had easily outrun him. Every night, Jason Marshall took 2 aspirins and pressed a heating pad against his sore hamstring muscle and drifted off into a fitful sleep, wondering where Dwayne Jr. was hiding. And every morning, Jason Marshall woke up thinking of evidence to follow that might lead him to the boy or at least lock up the arson case. On this particular day, the detective decided to skip church and do some internet research on handheld butane torches. The brand found in Dwayne Scrod Jr.'s book bag was called the Ultra Igniter, and the company's website helpfully provided a list of retail outlets that sold its products in Collier County. There were only 3, all hardware stores. One had gone out of business, and Jason Marshall figured the other 2 would be closed on a Sunday, but he was wrong. The store on the east side of Naples was open. The detective drove there, bringing a photograph of Dwayne Scrod Jr., that had been taken after his arrest for setting fire to the billboard.
The owner of the hardware store swore he'd never seen the kid before. "You sell lots of these ignited torches?" the detective asked.
"Not many," the store owner replied. "I can look it up on the computer and tell you the exact number."
The store had sold only 2 ultra igniters during the past 30 days. Jason Marshall wrote down the dates.
"You wouldn't happen to have the names of the customers, I suppose," the detective said.
"Nope. All I can tell you is that both items were bought with a credit card."
"You sure about that?"
"Yep. Our inventory software keeps track of whether it's a cash purchase or plastic," the store owner explained.
Jason Marshall thought it was highly unlikely that Dwayne Scott Jr. would be using a credit card unless it belonged to his father or he'd stolen it.
"I notice you've got security cameras," the detective said. "Doesn't everybody these days?"
"You still have the videotapes from the dates that you sold the Ultra Igniters?"
"I doubt it,"
the store owner replied, which was a lie. He saved all the security videotapes for 6 months in case they were needed to prosecute shoplifters. On this particular day, he just didn't feel like sifting through hours of videos.
"Let's take a look," Jason Marshall said.
"Actually, I'm sort of busy right now. Maybe you could stop by another time."
"I'm pretty busy myself," said Jason Marshall. "So let's see those tapes."
It didn't take very long to review the surveillance film, and the detective found both sales transactions that he was looking for. He informed the store owner that he was keeping the tapes as evidence.
"What's this all about?" the man asked worriedly. "Am I in trouble or something?"
"Not at all," Jason Marshall said.
Driving back to the sheriff's office, he phoned Torkelson, the arson investigator with the fire department. He told him he'd located a store that had sold 2 butane torches identical to the one found in the backpack of Dwayne Scott Jr.
"One was bought on the day before the fire at the swamp," the detective said.
"Good work."
"But the second torch was purchased only 3 days ago,"
the arson investigator said.
"I don't care about that one."
"Well, you should," Jason Marshall said, "because the same guy bought both of them, and it wasn't the Scrod kid."
"How do you know?"
"The hardware store has security cameras. I got the tapes."
There was an edgy silence on the other end. Torkelson, trying to figure out what this information could mean.
"Maybe the boy has an accomplice. Maybe they bought the second torch because they're planning another fire," he said finally. "How old is that customer on the video?"
"Between 55 and 60, I'd say."
"Oh," said Torkelson. "So it's not the boy's father?"
"No."
"There's got to be an explanation."
"I can think of one," the detective said.
"Let's hear it."
"Maybe we're after the wrong guy."
After another uneasy pause, the arson investigator said,
"I need to see those tapes."
"Yes, you do,"
agreed Jason Marshall.
The oak tree was 40 feet high and dead as a doornail, killed years earlier by a lightning strike. Way up high was a hole in the trunk where a female raccoon was living with 3 little ones. One day, a huge backhoe arrived on the lot and started smashing down trees. The boy, who'd been spying on the raccoon family for weeks, jumped off his bicycle and shouted at the driver of the backhoe to steer clear of the dead oak. But the driver never heard him. He just waved the boy away, revved the big machine, and flattened the den tree, killing all the raccoons, including the mother. The boy could do nothing but watch from a distance and sob. The construction company that owned the backhoe was clearing the property to make way for a patio furniture warehouse. 2 days after all the trees were demolished, the company set up a shiny, double-wide office trailer with a bright banner heralding the new project. That same night, the boy rode his bike out to the property and set fire to the double-wide, which burned to a rather immense and twisted cinder.
Nobody was inside at the time. I made sure of that, Smoke assured Nick, who listened to the entire arson story without interrupting. See, I'm not a true pyro, Smoke added. I didn't do it for kicks. I was just mad. Still, that's... dumb is the word. Same with torching the billboard, Smoke said. My mom had just taken off for Paris, and I was all messed up. When I saw that big sign for the airline, I flipped out. You wouldn't understand, dude. Nobody does. Nick didn't say a thing. It was impossible for him to envision his own mother getting on a plane and flying away forever without even saying goodbye. Such heartbreak was beyond Nick's experience. Smoke chuckled bitterly. They built that stupid furniture warehouse anyway, just like they put up a brand new billboard in the same spot as the other one. You set any other fires? Nick asked.
Never.
So why do you want people to call you Smoke?
Because it sounds a lot cooler than Dwayne.
They were sitting on the floor in Nick's bedroom. The shades were drawn and the door was locked. Twilly says you're a tracker, Nick said.
It's the one thing I'm good at, I guess.
He says that if anybody can find that Mother Panther, it's you.
I sure aim to try, Smoke spoke with determination. Mrs. Stark says there's not much time.
She's right. And this bloodhound sniffing all over the place doesn't make the job any easier, Smoke said. Wildcats run like crazy from dogs. Nick had to ask, what's the deal with you and her?
Mrs. Starch? You're not so bad.
Everybody thought you hated her guts after what happened in class. Smoke grinned.
For sure I did. But come to find out she's not as mean as she acts. Hey, I heard a car pull up.
Moments later, the front door opened and Nick's mother began calling his name. Smoke grabbed him by the shoulders. Don't say a word about me.
But I can't lie, Nick whispered.
Listen, bro. Once she knows I'm hiding here, she's got to tell the cops or else she can go to jail.
What are you talking about?
Harboring a fugitive is what I'm talking about, Smoke said. If you tell your mom I'm here, you're dragging her into the middle of this whole mess. Is that what you want? From down the hall, Nikki, where are you?
I'll be right out, Mom.
Smoke edged himself sideways into Nick's bedroom closet.
Go, he said to Nick. Act like nothing's wrong.
Nick slipped out the door and closed it behind him. He walked down the hall to the living room where he was surprised to see that his mother wasn't alone.
Nikki, you remember Peyton?
Sure, he said. Peyton Lynch had been one of Nick's regular babysitters back when he was in elementary school, and she was in high school. Now she attended junior college and worked part-time at a sandal shop.
Hey, Nikki,
she smacked through a cheek full of bubble gum. Nick's mother said Peyton would be staying at the house for a few days while she went to be with his father. There's a flight out of Fort Myers late this afternoon that connects to Washington.
That's good, Nick said.
And it was good, for Nick's dad and also for Nick. Peyton Lynch was a nice girl, but she wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, as Mrs. Starch might say. When Nick was little, he'd done pretty much whatever he'd please while Peyton was there, because she was usually yakking on the phone or painting her toenails blue or staring at MTV. She was the ideal babysitter. Clueless. One time when Nick was 9 years old, he'd accidentally bounced a golf ball through the screen of his desktop computer. Peyton hadn't heard the tube explode because her headphones were turned up so loud, nor had she shown the slightest spark of curiosity when Nick had emerged from his room carrying a box full of broken glass. Nick's mother said, "Make yourself at home, Peyton. I'll go finish packing." Peyton dropped her travel bag on the rug and plopped down on the sofa.
So, how's school, Nicky?
It's okay, he said.
Hey, you guys got any Diet Snapple?
I don't think so.
Green tea?
She asked, plugging the iPod buds into her ears.
Tofu burgers? Spring rolls?
I'll check the fridge, said Nick, smiling to himself.
Peyton Lynch would never notice that Duane Scrod Jr. was staying at the house as long as he didn't park his motorcycle in the kitchen. Drake McBride was extremely annoyed. With a groan, he pushed himself out of bed and hobbled after Jimmy Lee Bayless to the sitting room, where the dog handler waited somberly.
"What happened?" Drake McBride demanded, with no trace of sympathy.
The dog handler said,
"You owe me $2,000.
"Because your dumbass dog got lost? You out of your mind?"
"Hoss didn't get lost," the man said flatly. "I ain't leaving here till I get my money."
Jimmy Lee Bayless bit his lip. He'd strongly urged his boss to pay the man and be done with it, but Drake McBride said, "No way, partner, not one red cent."
"Here's what I think," Drake McBride said, buttoning his purple pajama top. "I think you tried to scam us with a defective hound dog. I think old Horace couldn't find his own butt in a bread box."
The handler wasn't as tall as Drake McBride, but he was wiry and tough. Jimmy Lee Bayless knew the type. "Look, whatever happened out there, the man's dog is gone," Jimmy Lee Bayless said to his boss, "and we need to reach some sort of agreement."
"Horace was a champion tracker," the handler stated proudly. "Horace was the best."
"Horace was a dud," Drake McBride cackled. "Whoever heard of a champion bloodhound getting lost?"
At that point, Jimmy Lee Bayless realized that nothing could be done to save Drake McBride from his own big mouth. The president of the Red Diamond Energy Corporation was now pinned against the wall of the hotel room, his face turning the same color as his ridiculous pajamas.
"Horace did not get himself lost. He got killed," the dog handler said, squeezing. "And he got it."
Jimmy Lee Bayless attempted to pry the man's hands from Drake McBride's neck, but the handler was very strong and very angry. Drake McBride's eyeballs were bulging and his arms were flapping, and mousy little squeaks were leaking out of his lungs.
"Let go of him, please," Jimmy Lee Bayless implored. "He'll pay you the $2,000. And apologize for what he said about Horace.
He'll take out an ad in the paper if you want."
The dog handler released his hold on Drake McBride, who crumpled to his knees on the carpet. After 5 solid minutes of hacking and wheezing, he finally recaptured his breath and said he was sorry.
"Give me my money," the handler said.
"You say your dog was eaten?"
"Bet on it."
"Eaten by what, if I might ask?"
"Like you don't know," the man said coldly.
Drake McBride looked quizzically at Jimmy Lee Bayless.
"What's he talking about now?"
To himself, Jimmy Lee Bayless thought,
"I'm employed by a total moron."
"He's talking about a panther, sir."
"Ha! Ain't no panthers out there,"
Drake McBride declared. But it was all bluster. His face was a pale mask of anxiety. The dog handler said,
"I saw the sket myself."
"You're mistaken, pal. Most likely a bobcat."
"Yeah?"
The man yanked Drake McBride to his feet and then shoved him into an armchair.
"I know bobcat sket from panther sket, and what I saw didn't come from no puny bobcat."
In fear of another throttling, Drake McBride gave up the argument.
"Whatever you say, you're the expert."
"That I am," the handler said.
To bring the conversation to a peaceful end, Jimmy Lee Bayless explained to Drake McBride that the handler would never have allowed Horace to track a scent through the Black Vine Swamp if he'd known a panther was lurking in the area. "The dog's purely a human hunter, not a cat hunter," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "I believe we got an obligation to compensate this man for his loss."
All right,"
Drake McBride mumbled and limped to the bedroom to get his checkbook. The handler said,
"Out west they use special cat hounds for hunting cougars. But Horace, he wasn't schooled for that. He probably just run up on that old panther without even barking and got himself killed and hit. Thing is, I had a fondness for that old fella.
We're very sorry this happened. Deeply sorry, Jimmy Lee Bayless said in his most sincere-sounding voice.
You ought to be, said the handler.
Mr. McBride and I had no idea there was a dangerous panther on our land.
Know what? I think you're both full of crap.
Jimmy Lee Bayless didn't dispute the point. His boss returned and slumped into the armchair, a ballpoint pen in one hand and a checkbook open on his lap. With forced politeness, he said,
2,000 even, right?
The dog handler rubbed his leathery chin in a pondering way that caused Jimmy Lee Bayless to grope for his tums.
Right before Horace disappeared, he struck a red-hot trail, the handler recalled. It led us off your company's land all the way over to the next section, where you can't believe what I found. Maybe you can.
Jimmy Lee Bayless swallowed a sour burp. Drake McBride's shoulders drooped.
There was a big old stack of pipes and boxes of drilling gear, the dog handler went on. Like somebody was fixing to sink an oil well on state property. You can never guess what name was on the labels of them crates. Or maybe you can. It was Red Diamond Energy, same as your outfit. Ain't that odd?
Drake McBride looked up and croaked.
What exactly do you want from me, mister?
The handler gave a long, phony sigh.
I sure do miss my hound dog,
Jimmy Lee Bayless said. Let's cut to the chase. How does $5,000 sound?
Real fine as how it sounds to me.
But if anyone ever asks, you never set foot in Section 22, did you? You didn't see no mud pit or drilling equipment, well, nothing.
No, sir, the handler said. The only one who knows different is Horace, and he ain't here to spill the beans. God rest his soul.
Drake McBride scowled.
Stop! You're gonna make me cry.
He scribbled a check for $5,000 and handed it to the handler.
Here, go buy yourself another mutt, he said and staggered back to bed.
24. Nick felt himself being shaken roughly. He hoped it was a dream because he wasn't ready to wake up.
Move it, a hushed voice commanded.
Nick opened one eye and saw Dwayne Scrod Jr. standing over him, dressed in hunting camo.
Twilly just called, said the kid, holding up his cell phone. We gotta go.
Where?
There.
But what about school? Nick asked.
Smoke grabbed his ankles and hauled him out of the sheets.
Go write a note to your babysitter.
She's not my babysitter.
Whatever. Put a note in the kitchen. Tell her you got a ride to Truman for one of the seniors.
But it's still nighttime, Nick said.
No, dude, that's fog.
Nick dressed in his regular school outfit, including a necktie and blazer, in case Peyton Lynch woke up and saw him leaving. He didn't know that she was in a deep, bear-like sleep, having been up until 3 a.m. texting back and forth with girlfriends who were on a trip to Hong Kong. Together, Nick and Smoke slipped out the front door.
Are we taking the motorcycle?
Nick asked, wondering if he dressed warmly enough for an open ride.
Twilly said no, the muffler's too noisy, Smoke said. Today we need to be quiet.
At the end of the block, they came upon the blue Prius, parked with its headlights on. Although the windshield was glossy with dew, Nick could make out two upright shapes inside the car. He assumed it was Twilly and Mrs. Starch, and he was half right. The driver's window rolled down, and Twilly told Nick and Smoke to get in the back seat. Once they were buckled in, Twilly pointed at his four-legged passenger.
Say hello to Horace.
With droopy eyelids, the bloodhound turned toward the boys, a string of pearly drool unspooling from its lower lip. Smoke crowed delightedly.
Is that the same one that was chasing us?
All is forgiven, Twilly said from behind his black sunglasses.
Nick stroked the dog's silky ears.
Don't tell me he fell for the old raw hamburger trick.
Nah, it was steak, Tully said.
One sniff and Horace decided I was his new best friend.
Turns out he's pretty good company. Doesn't ask lots of nosy questions.
How'd you know his name's Horace?
Because that's what his boss man was hollering all over the woods after he lost him. By the way, Tully said, eyeing Nick in the rear view, why are you dressed like an usher? Or is that what you usually wear on a hike through the swamp?
No, I had to look like I was on my way to school, Nick said, reddening. He shed his Truman blazer and yanked off his tie.
So why are you wearing shades? He said sharply to Tully. It's practically dark out.
Not to me.
Smoke asked, did you find some more you-know-what?
Yep, Tully said.
How fresh?
2 hours tops.
Nick sat forward excitedly. Panther scat!
Right, said Tully.
Smoke looked out the window of the car.
Awesome, he murmured.
Nick borrowed Smoke's cell phone to call Marta, who begged to come along. At first, Tully balked, but Smoke spoke up and said it couldn't hurt to have an extra set of eyes and ears on the hunt. Nick instructed Marta to meet them at the mailbox near the bus stop, and she was waiting in jeans and a hooded sweatshirt when the car pulled up. She was so excited that she practically hurled herself into the back seat. It took a few moments before she noticed the large, slobbering dog in the front.
"What's the deal with him?" she said.
"That's just Horace," said Nick.
"He's a bloodhound," Smoke added. "A good one."
Horace yawned at the compliment.
Marta said, "Oh, I get it. He's going to help track down the Mama Panther."
Tully made a noise like a game show buzzer.
"Wrong," he said. "Horace will soon be tied under a tree, snoring like a train. He doesn't do cats."
"He's a trained manhunter," Smoke explained.
"Where'd he come from?" Marta asked.
Nick said, "Tully dog-napped him."
"Not true. I bribed him with a T-bone, that's all," said Tully.
He drove slower than normal because of the soupy fog, so it took a while to reach the dirt road leading to the Blackvine Swamp. Along the way, he pulled over briefly to snug the seatbelt around Horace, which Nick thought was a good idea. A bouncy ride could cause unpleasant problems for a big dog with a full stomach, and also for the other passengers. They concealed Mr. Starch's car in the same place as before, beneath the same strangler fig, and set out on foot. Tully led Horace on a rope leash, and Smoke followed next. Nick and Marta stayed closer that they wouldn't get left behind in the fog, which hung like a wet woolen shroud over the marsh and tree islands. A small fire was burning at Tully's camp. Smoke joined Marta and Nick as they stood beside it, the heat feeling glorious on their cheeks. Tully tied the hound to a cabbage palm and set out a bowl of water, which was loudly slurped up. Afterward, Tully made a pot of coffee and everybody had a cup. Tully told them to drink up quickly. Nick wasn't crazy about the taste, but he was grateful for the warm rush. Mrs. Starch came out of her tent holding the straw hat. The baby panther popped its head up and cried plaintively.
"Patience, dear Squirt," Mrs. Starch said to the kitten.
The three kids gathered around to look. As adorable as it was, the cat was restless and squirmy and not very huggable. Nick noticed long, nasty scratch marks on Mrs. Starch's arms. Meanwhile, Horace the bloodhound had already dozed off under the palm tree. Tully stood away from the fire, pressing buttons on his handheld GPS. He said, "The good news is they won't be using helicopters to hunt for us, not in this weather. The bad news is it's going to be twice as hard for us to find this little guy's mother." Mrs. Starch fixed an iron gaze on Nick and Marta.
"Silence on the trail is absolutely essential," she told them. "One tiny human sneeze could scare the mama cat away for good. That would be a death sentence for Squirt. Do you understand? He can't live on zoo milk forever."
Marta and Nick nodded soberly. Both were thinking of the other panther cub, the one that had died.
"Time to go," Smoke said.
Tully ducked into his tent
and emerged with the rifle.
"What's that for?" Marta asked nervously.
"Peace of mind." Tully checked his ammo belt to make sure that the bullet sleeves were full. "Everybody ready?" The miniature panther growled impatiently inside the straw hat, and even Twilly laughed. They filed out of the clearing and into the misted woods, Twilly leading the way, followed by Dwayne Scrott Jr., Nick, Marta, and lastly Mrs. Starch, pressing a bottle of formula to the hungry cub's mouth. For almost half an hour, they hiked briskly yet quietly through cypress woods, flatlands, hammocks, and then more pines and palmetto scrub. The fog only seemed to get thicker, wetter, colder. Twilly was using the GPS unit to retrace his earlier steps. Without it, Nick knew they'd never find what they were looking for. Not a word was spoken, even by Marta, when she briefly lost a sneaker in the muck. Likewise, Mrs. Starch did not utter the faintest cry when the panther kitten, miffed because the milk had run out, swatted her nose with an oversized paw, drawing blood. At last, Twilly motioned for the search party to halt and gather around him. He bent down and carefully lifted a palmetto frond, revealing on the ground a dark greenish pile of unmistakable origin, containing tufts of deer hair, bits of bones, and wisps of white egret feathers. Marta pointed at the smelly lump and silently mouthed the words, "Panther poop." Twilly made a thumbs-up sign. Dwayne Scrott Jr. dropped to one knee and began examining the scat. The only extraordinary sound in the swamp was that of the baby panther rumbling inside Mrs. Starch's straw hat. Nick felt Marta gently take hold of his shirt tail. After a few moments, smoke rose and began to move stealthily in small, weightless steps along a tangled trail that he alone could detect. The others followed, their hearts hammering with anticipation. Jimmy Lee Bayless thought it would be best if he spoke to the game warden alone, but Drake McBride insisted on coming along. Jimmy Lee Bayless had already told Melton and the rest of the crew to take the morning off in order to avert any risk of the federal officer overhearing Red Diamond's machinery at work in Section 22. The jostling drive to the Black Vine Swamp was murder on Drake McBride's fractured ribs, and he groaned and cussed the whole time. Jimmy Lee Bayless stopped the company truck near the entrance to the public boardwalk. He'd never seen fog so thick. It was like a cold, clinging smoke. Drake McBride got out, rubbing his bandaged midsection. He was still mad about the $5,000 he'd given to the owner of the missing bloodhound.
"You think a panther really snacked on that dog? No way, partner."
"Doesn't matter," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "We had no choice but to pay the man off."
Drake McBride snorted scornfully.
"He's nothing but a skimmer."
"Whatever."
"He found the well pit in Section 22, Jimmy Lee Bayless reminded his boss for the 10th time. "He would have ratted us out if we didn't give him some money."
"Man, I hate scammers,"
Drake McBride said. Jimmy Lee Bayless laughed. He couldn't help it. He completely understood why Drake McBride's father thought his son was a boob. A green pickup rolled out of the haze and stopped. On the side of the truck was the logo of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Drake McBride said,
"Let me deal with this punk, Jimmy Lee."
The punk turned out to be a good bit older than Drake McBride, though much more physically fit. He wore a badge and carried a gun on his hip, and he introduced himself as Special Agent Conway.
"Special Agent?"
Drake McBride smirked.
"So you're like James Bond of the boonies."
"And who would you be?" Conway said.
"Drake McBride. I'm the president of Red Diamond Energy."
"Right." Conway looked at Jimmy Lee Bayless. "And you?"
"He's my project manager," Drake McBride said. "Mr. Bayless is his name. Let me save all of us from wasting one more second of our precious time. There's no panthers out here, okay? Nada. Somebody made a big mistake."
Conway smiled politely.
We received a report from a citizen who was quite certain he saw one in this area, so we're required to check it out. But not today, gentlemen, not in this heavy fog. Jimmy Lee Bayless quietly exhaled in relief. Drake McBride simmered. Where does the boundary of your oil lease start? Conway asked. 3/4 mile down the road, Jimmy Lee Bayless said, pointing. There's a sign and a metal gate. Leave it unlocked tomorrow morning, the Fish and Wildlife agent advised. If there's no weather, I'll be back with a couple of other officers and a tracking dog.
Great, muttered Drake McBride under his breath. Another mutt.
Excuse me?
Nothing.
Jimmy Lee Bayless quickly cut in. We'll cooperate totally, Agent Conway. Well, whatever you need us to do, consider it done.
Good.
The officer took off his wire-rimmed eyeglasses and wiped the condensation from the lenses. Hardly any animal on Earth is more endangered than the Florida panther. Are you aware of that? There's somewhere between 60 and 100 left. That's all. And our job is to try and save them from extinction. That's why we follow up on possible sightings.
But I told you there can't possibly be a sighting out here because there ain't no damn panthers, Drake McBride protested.
The officer said, they're really quite beautiful. Ever seen a picture?
No, but I've seen cougars out west shot dead and of skinned, where it's all proper and legal, basically the same varmint.
Conway put on his glasses and turned his back on the president of the Red Diamond Energy Corporation. Make sure you leave that gate unlocked, he said to Jimmy Lee Bayless. Yes, sir. Can I ask who it was that called up and said they saw one of those cats around here? Conway walked to his truck and looked at his clipboard. The name on the report is Hayduk, he said. George W. Hayduk. The name meant nothing to Jimmy Lee Bayless or his boss, who hadn't finished a book since his junior year of college. He gave a GPS waypoint, too, Conway added. So we've got a good place to start. Really? Jimmy Lee Bayless suddenly felt queasy. Sulking, Drake McBride said,
So I guess any old crackpot can call up the U.S. government and say he saw a panther or a unicorn or even a UFO, and you guys put a posse together the next day. Is that how it works?
Special Agent Conway got in his truck and rolled down the window. Be careful in this fog, he said, and drove off. Detective Jason Marshall had received 2 unexpected phone calls that Monday morning. The first was from a man named Bernard Beanstoop III, otherwise known as Bernie the Bean, who was only the most famous and most expensive criminal defense lawyer in Tampa. Bernie the Bean informed Jason Marshall that he'd been hired by the grandmother of Duane Scrod Jr. to represent the young man accused of arson. Bernie the Bean said he was currently working with the family to find Duane Jr. and persuade him to turn himself in. The attorney also stated that the boy was 1,000% innocent and would fight all the charges pending against him.
But he ran away from me, the detective pointed out. That's resisting arrest.
Extenuating circumstances, chirped Bernie the Bean. The poor kid simply freaked. Anyway, if you should find Duane before we do, please inform him that his grandma already got him an attorney. And not just any attorney, the best. The conversation was not a bright spot for Jason Marshall, who'd been nursing doubts about the Black Vine Swamp case ever since visiting the hardware store where the butane torches had been sold. No less troubling was the second phone call of the day. It came from an eager state prosecutor who told the detective not to fret about the videotapes showing that the torches weren't purchased by Duane Scrod Jr. The fugitive teenager remained the prime suspect, the prosecutor asserted. The tapes don't prove that punk didn't set the fire, he added. They just prove he didn't shop at that particular store. Heck, he could have bought the exact same brand of torch over the Internet. Which is probably true, the detective thought. Yet still it seemed like a suspicious coincidence given the timing of the arson.
The only mystery in this case, the prosecutor went on, is how a rotten apple like Scrod ever got into a private school as good as Truman. I mean, your daughter goes there, right, Jason?
She does, the detective said tightly.
Well, if it were my kid, that would seriously sketch me out. Guy with a rap sheet like Scrod's, walking the same halls?
I'll let you know the minute we find him, the detective said without much enthusiasm.
Torkelson, the fire investigator, arrived at the sheriff's department at 10 o'clock sharp. Jason Marshall took him to his office and shared his misgivings about the case. Torkelson listened thoughtfully, then said,
May I see the tapes?
The detective queued up a VCR and sat down behind Torkelson, who watched each of the two video loops, pausing repeatedly to study the features of the man popping antacid pills at the cash register while waiting to pay for the ultra-igniter butane torches.
That's not the Scrod boy, Jason Marshall said. Obviously.
The fire investigator hunched in front of the television screen, his knuckles propped beneath his chin.
Well, what do you think? Jason Marshall asked. I think our prosecutor friend is going to be extremely disappointed.
Torkelson punched the pause button on the VCR, clicked open his briefcase, and removed a clear plastic bag, which he held up for the detective to see. Inside the baggie was a cheap ballpoint pen stamped with the name of Red Diamond Energy. Jason Marshall said,
I remember that pen. You found it near the flashpoint of the arson. That's right, said Torkelson. The man who lost it is the same one who later called to say he'd found the boy's book bag at the scene.
The detective tightened his necktie. Smiling now, he said,
How about that? The same book bag with the butane torch hidden in the pocket. Yeah, how about that?
The fire investigator turned back to the TV screen where the torch buyer's face was frozen in black and white, grainy yet easily identified.
His name is Jimmy Lee Bayless, Torkelson said. He works for that oil company, Red Diamond.
Jason Marshall managed to appear calm and professional, although he was very excited.
So it went down like this. Bayless goes to the hardware store and buys torch number one to start the fire with.
Torkelson nodded.
Probably got rid of it the same day.
But later, when he finds out that you know it was arson, he gets worried.
More like panic-stricken.
So he rushes out to the same store and buys another identical torch, the detective said, to frame the Scrod boy for the crime.
That's how it adds up, doesn't it?
The fire investigator returned the incriminating ballpoint pen to his briefcase. Jason Marshall stood up and checked the back of his belt to make sure he had the case containing his handcuffs. He said, there's still one big piece of the puzzle missing. Why did Bayless set fire to that swamp in the first place? Torkelson popped the videotape out of the VCR.
Let's go ask him.
25. It was like tiptoeing through clouds. Moistened by the fog, Nick's shirt stuck to his chest. His skin felt slick and tiny droplets of dew hung like silvery globes in his eyelashes. The swamp was bathed in a pale gray twilight. Nick could hardly believe that it was morning and that somewhere high above hung the sun, blazing. Smoke advanced steadily in pursuit of the mother panther, pausing now and then to point out a broken sprig, a flattened tuft of grass, or a partial paw print. With each step, the searchers drew closer to the cat, yet she remained an unseen phantom, a vapor of imagination. Was she running, hiding in wait, watching from the bough of an oak? Tully Spree had removed his lucky necklace because he feared the clicking of the dried buzzard beaks would alert the panther. He stayed at Smoke's heels, carrying his rifle by its stock, the bluish barrel pointed skyward. Marta had dropped back a couple of steps to walk with Mrs. Starch and to be near the sleeping kitten. Nick marveled at how quietly the five of them had learned to move together through scratchy brush and sodden marsh, in fluid unison, like a centipede or the muscles of a snake. But he also knew that panthers possessed a keen sense of hearing, that a muffled cough or a slight clearing of the throat could spook the cat into flight, and it might not settle down for miles. Tracking such a wary animal required so much stealth and concentration that Nick's thoughts couldn't stray far, which was a good thing. It would have been a long, restless day at school, hour upon hour, in which to worry about his father lying on the operating table at the military hospital. The cat hunt was a perfect distraction, physically and emotionally. Nick had never felt more focused, more absorbed. He had no clue where they were, even what direction they were heading, until the boardwalk appeared out of the mist. Smoke abruptly shrank to a crouch, and the others did the same. Twilly signaled urgently for Mrs. Starch to bring the cub to the front of the line. Carrying her straw hat with both arms, as if it held some rare and fragile treasure, the gangly teacher moved forward with wavering, slow-motion steps. She reminded Nick of a stork sneaking up on a bug. He groped behind him for Marta's hand and tugged her close so that she could see better. Smoke was up again, peering into the bank of fog. Twilly whispered to Mrs. Starch, and she removed the baby panther from the crown of her hat. The kitten stretched its stubby legs and yawned mightily. Then it began to squirm and writhe and thrash, the plump, oversized claws raking Mrs. Starch's hands and forearms. Somehow she got the cat under control, but Nick and Marta were surprised to see so much power in such a small, cute-looking package. Soon the kitten began to cry, which brought a fond smile to Mrs. Starch and affirming nods from Twilly and Smoke. The crying is what they hoped would draw the mother panther out of the woods, what they hoped would lead her to the cub, but only if she heard it. Smoke said something to Twilly, who stiffened and swung his rifle to a ready position. Nick felt Marta's breath on his neck.
Somebody else is out here. No way. Listen, Nick. Voices.
Smoke must have heard them, too, although Nick didn't. The only sounds that registered in his ears were the mewling of the kitten and the thump-thumping of his own heart. When Mrs. Starch released the cub, it scampered a few yards to a small clearing and then sat down abruptly, wide-eyed and bewildered. Twilly motioned for everyone to back away. They regrouped in a stand of young pines, where, despite the fog, they still had a view of Squirt, a spotted puff of fur on the ground. The little panther cried and cried, yet instinctively it knew not to move, for even a twitch might catch the attention of a hawk.
"Hurry, Mama Cat,"
Mrs. Starch murmured in an aching voice unfamiliar to Nick and Marta. This was not the same person who terrorized them in biology class.
"Did you actually see the panther?"
Nick whispered to Smoke, who shook his head.
"But she's not far," he said.
"How do you know?"
Marta asked.
"There was fresh pee on our resurrection fern."
"Lovely." Nick asked Smoke if he, like Marta, had heard voices.
"Yeah, bro, I did," he said apprehensively.
Twilly wasn't watching the kitten. He was scanning the trees and thickets, the gun pulled tight against his chest. The cub's cries sounded pitiful and small in the great swamp, like squeaks from a stuffed nursery toy.
"Don't give up, little guy," Mrs. Stark said. She was clutching her straw hat so fiercely it had crumpled in her fists.
Marta shut her eyes. Nick figured she was saying a prayer for the baby cat. Her family was very religious, and Marta never missed church on Sundays. Nick thought, a prayer couldn't hurt. The seconds ticked by with agonizing slowness, and the sounds from the cub became weaker. The cat was getting tired of crying.
"Not good," Smoke said.
Twilly agreed. "Let's give it 5 more minutes." The kitten must have heard their whispers, for it pricked its ears and turned its head toward their hiding place among the pines. Mrs. Starch said, "This is breaking my heart." From deep in the fog arose a high-pitched scream,
piercing and raw like something from a slasher movie. Twilly froze, Mrs. Starch gasped, and Marta dug her fingernails into Nick's shoulder. "Panther," Smoke said triumphantly. Then came the gunshots. Long after Special Agent Conway's truck disappeared into the mist, Drake McBride and Jimmy Lee Bayless paced back and forth on the dirt road. They were having an uncomfortable conversation about the future of the Section 22 oil scam.
"We're doomed," Drake McBride stated bitterly. "We're toast."
"Maybe not. Remember, it's the government," said Jimmy Lee Bayless. "Half of everything they do is half-assed."
"No, you heard the man. They're going to have rangers tromping all over this swamp, plus a dog, too, probably a serious dog. They're bound to find our drill site, Jimmy Lee, and then we are doomed."
Jimmy Lee Bayless feared that for once his boss was right. The officer searching for the Panther probably would find the pirate well first, and then Red Diamond Energy would be in deep trouble for trying to steal petroleum from land belonging to the good citizens of Florida.
"You got nothing else to say? That's it?"
Drake McBride spluttered. "I'm just thinking," Jimmy Lee Bayless said.
"Thinking about what? Which of us gets the top bunk in our prison cell?"
Actually, Jimmy Lee Bayless was thinking about Mexico. On TV, it looked like a warm and friendly place to live where nobody asked too many questions. There had to be direct flights from Tampa or maybe Orlando. The question was, had he left his passport back in Texas? Drake McBride rubbed his sore ribs and griped about all the rotten luck that had befallen him.
"I'd give anything to know who called the feds about that cat. Had to be the same joker been messing with Melton."
"No doubt," said Jimmy Lee Bayless. His mind flashed back to the spectacle of all those little pink flags mischievously rearranged to tell the Red Diamond helicopter to S-C-A-T.